Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Life's defining moments don't always feel that great when they are happening. In the moment, they can feel challenging, uncomfortable, difficult, impossible even. But with hindsight, they can take on a different shape. Each week, I ask my guests to share their biggest life learnings to date as we explore those difficult, swampy, infuriating times and how they shaped them, all from a comfortable distance that's afforded them the time to take the positive out of what might have seemed nothing but negative at the time. Because whether it's risks, excuses, obstacles, opportunities both missed and taken, successes, regrets, curveballs, weaknesses, strengths, and perhaps the hardest lesson of all, being wrong, they are the reason they are the person they are today, the person sitting in front of me on this episode of The Emma Gunn Show. My guest today is Anna Martha, the psychotherapist and best-selling author who has taken her knowledge and made it accessible to many outside the therapy room to help them access mental health advice. With nearly 200,000 followers on Instagram, she has become one of the most trusted voices talking about mental health, motherhood, and more on the platform. Anna was born in Bromsgrove and studied social psychology at Loughborough University before earning a certificate in psychotherapy and counselling and then an MA in psychotherapy and counselling. She has worked consistently as a counsellor and psychotherapist, and now director of Anna Martha Psychology, is also the author of 3 Sunday Times best-selling books. Her podcast, The Therapy Edit, is described as pep talks packed with grounding words for motherhood feelings and tackles everything from how to accept help from others and how to deal with resentment. Anna runs a series of courses via her website covering subjects including anxiety, people-pleasing, self-worth, new mums and more. She is passionate about sharing her insights on the tools and strategies that have changed the lives of her clients and transformed hers too. Anna Martha, welcome to The Emma Gunn Show.
Wow, it's quite something hearing it all read out there.
It is weird, isn't it? It's like, here's what you did.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we, you know, life is so full on in the moment. You rarely pause and look back and think, oh, I have done some stuff.
I have a friend who, whenever I start complaining about the fact that I'm not where I want to be, she just stops me and says, if you told Emma a year ago that Emma here and now will be doing this, you wouldn't stop it.
Yeah.
It's quite good advice.
That is so helpful. Yeah, I often think. Oh, yeah, I have that same thought. And it just, yeah, I wouldn't have dreamed of it, actually. I didn't even know that you could do therapy like this.
So was it not the plan?
No, I was working in GP surgeries and in my living room on my sofa, seeing clients there. You know, didn't even do anything online back then. Wasn't really even on Instagram. And I downloaded Instagram because I was moving house into a new build house and was like, what do I do with all these white walls? And found whole communities of people that had new build houses and were also wondering what to do with their white walls. And so that's what I did, screenshots of lamps and stuff. So that wasn't hounding my friends. And then I remember someone saying, what do you do for an actual thing? And I said, I'm a therapist. And I got a couple of questions my way around, have you got any tips for anxiety? And I thought, wow, I can share some of that knowledge here and take it out of that therapy room. And I didn't even know that that was a thing. And that's kind of where it started.
The little seed.
Yeah, the tiny little seed.
So
little lamps.
What was the draw to become a therapist? Because I do think that it attracts a particular type of person. And
yeah,
it does.
People that need therapy normally. Do you know what? I really do think that when you become a therapist, you tend to get the therapy that you needed all along. And I think so many people that I trained with, they just wanted to help people. They just wanted to help people. And often those of us who thrive so much on helping people tending to maybe try and sidestep our own stuff.
Mm.
You know, the people that are the ones that everyone goes to, the kind of the agony aunts, the friendship groups, or the mums on the nights out, you know, they're the ones that find it, I don't know, it's like a role.
Mm.
And often there's a reason. And there was definitely a reason I found it easier to support other people. And I found it quite hard to let people support me. So it was the perfect job, really. I can carry on doing that forever.
And we're going to come onto this because at some point you do have to help yourself, but maybe that's a little bit further along in the journey.
Okay.
So let's start. So my first question to all my guests is, what is your relationship like with risk? Because I think that, and I'm not a psychotherapist, so you can tell me, I think that's a really interesting, it's a very confronting and exposing question that always sort of lets people's guard down, I think.
Yeah, I'm a risky person.
Oh.
But I also think I have a real privilege to be able to take risks. So, for example, when I moved into London, I just kind of got the cheapest flat going, and I really wanted to get a job in marketing, advertising, because it sounded really fun. And I think I'd just earn enough money to pay the rent so that I could take some risks. As long as I had enough money to kind of pay to get by, it didn't really matter. And then I took the risk of going into training, and my grandfather had died and left my mum a bit of money. So I kind of borrowed that and then kept paying it back. And then also with my husband, he's got quite a consistent job. So I could take that risk of starting a therapy practice. So I think I love taking risks. I'm not my husband tends to be the kind of the one that's really thinking about worst case scenarios. You know, he's always playing devil's advocate with me when I'm like, oh, let's do this. And he's like, oh, should we just think about that? So I don't know. I'm quite impulsive. Maybe, but then I think I tend to have some kind of safety net there. So I wonder what I'd be like if there was a, I don't know, an opportunity that came up and I didn't have that safety net, whether I'd make that jump.
So how did you transition from marketing? And I do believe that many women in their 30s and 40s go into either marketing or journalism because all of the protagonists in the films that we watched growing up,
that's so true,
were female journalists working in marketing or something else, or advertising. It was, so I just think we all thought, I'll do what they're doing on the cinema screen. But what was the transition from a job like that, which is quite media, quite fun, to what you're doing now, which is a lot of work, a lot of intense study?
Yeah, it's very different. So I did a psychology degree and I absolutely loved it, but you couldn't really go and then be a psychologist. It's one of those kind of degrees where you come out and you're like, oh, I've got a psychology degree, but I can't be a psychologist because that's another however many years of training. And I decided, do you know what? I remember going to a friend's house for a party and she had a pencil on her desk and it was really nice branding and it was for an advertising agency. So I was like, wow, that's... where's that from? She told me that she'd done kind of a placement there. And I thought, that sounds amazing. So I used to come down to London, visit my then boyfriend, wear a black dress, go and sit in a coffee shop and just basically hound all of these different ad agencies that I'd found on Google and say, can I come and have an interview? And I got a job on reception. And that's how I got into it. And I just because I didn't really know exactly what else to do. And I liked the idea that you could, I don't know, do something in branding. I thought that was really cool. But honestly, I was good at it, but I hated it because I'm not naturally that good at admin. And I worked as an accounts executive and it was all just admin. Mm. And I was good at it because I knew I was bad. So I couldn't trust myself. So I had to work so hard. And I remember going into an appraisal and they said, you know, Anna, if you just work a little bit harder on this and that, you can get a promotion. And I burst into tears because I thought, I don't want to get a promotion. I don't like it at all. So
that's a harsh realization.
Yeah. But I think sometimes we just kind of end up on this, I don't know, like a conveyor belt.
Mm.
And you almost feel like you just look around, you see what you should want. And then you go down that route. And sometimes we go too far down that route and then we feel like we can't step off. And I feel grateful that I did step off.
I think it's incredible to step off. And also because I think that we're sold this idea that, yeah, you've got to get on a path. You can call that path, but really it's kind of, it's a path that has momentum. So it is like one of those walking things at the airport.
Yes.
But sometimes you have to vault over the side or run in the other direction because it's the wrong one.
Yeah, and I ended up working in for temp agencies and doing all sorts of kind of data input and admin. I worked in Sainsbury's head office switchboard, which I flipping loved.
Why did you love that?
I just loved the variety of people that I was sat with, and I loved racing to pick up the phone. And you know, we'd have these call logs to see who'd logged the most calls, and I, you know, we were all just competing, and it was fun because I decided at that point that I was going to do my psychotherapy training. So I'd sit there with my books as well and kind of read between redirecting calls around the building.
Interesting.
So I loved some of those jobs.
And I know that you'd done the degree, so it was kind of maybe it was an obvious thing once you decided that marketing wasn't what you were going to do. But what was the kind of final push that meant, okay, I'm going to commit to this again?
So I'm trying to think. I knew that I loved the psychology, but a lot of places wouldn't take you until you're 25.
Mm-hmm. And how old at this point?
I was 23, 24. So I think it was because of the life experience thing, you know, because when you're 25, then you've got all the life experience you need. You've got it all under your belt. So I had to wait until I was 25. So that's what I did.
You had to buy some time.
Absolutely.
So was it a big risk, though? Was it something that felt like, given all the work that you'd done up to that point, because you'd still put some years into your other life, if it were, did it feel like a big jump? Did you have people saying, is that really a good idea?
I think I was just so excited. I think I'd worked out that the corporate kind of, the advertising world was just not for me. And I think that would just cause me to reassess things. And I think I was going through a really hard time mentally. I was really, really low. I was feeling really depressed. And a lot of the things we're going to touch on will kind of give insight into how that came about. And I just, honestly, I really think I just wanted to help people. That's what gave me purpose. That's what made me feel valid and like I deserve my place in the world. And I think because I was feeling so low, I felt even more driven to make that my job. You know, I feel good when I'm helping people. So therefore, and I'm going to formalize that and make that a thing for me. And that's going to be my life. I'm going to help people.
Mm. We've talked about that, but I'm going way off course because actually when we talked about what your biggest risk was, you said it was marriage.
Said
that you have all of life's answers at 25, but marriage is something you did at 24.
I did. Yeah. So I started my training just after we got married, and it was like one of the hardest points of my life. And marriage was a risk in the sense that, you know, looking back, I felt so grown up, but I was also so broken. I was I was so vulnerable. All my life I'd felt like I had been the grown up, like right from being very small. So my sister had cancer when I was really young and she died when I was 10. And my way of coping was very much even then to be the good one and to be the kind of the neat person, not to upset anyone with my own grief. Didn't want to kind of set anyone else off or worry anyone. So I very much learned at a young age to kind of wrap myself up quite neatly. And I think that just started, there's only so long you can do that. You could suppress so much of yourself in the process of being easy for everybody else. And I think when I got married, I started realizing that out of pursuing to do that, to make life easy for everyone else, I was actually hurting the people that I love the most because it was painful for them to see me struggling. Mm-hmm. Because no matter how independent you feel you are, you can't be everything for yourself. And I think you can end up shutting a lot of people out who would like to be your support network. And I think that can be very hard to see. So some of the ways that I was coping, there was a lot of kind of disordered eating and just a lot of kind of control. And I thought that that really only affected me. But I think when I got married and started living, literally sharing a house with my husband after we got married, I started realizing that actually that was painful for him as well. And it just gave me this whole new perspective on kind of just control and perfectionism. We try and keep ourselves under wraps. We end up keeping other people out. And really life, the richness of life is about relationship. And we kind of, we hamper that opportunity for people to get close to us when we're constantly trying to hide so much of ourselves.
It's really complicated, isn't it? That idea of you didn't want to be a bother, you didn't want to be difficult or to cause any stress. And actually to try to be the sort of the greasiest wheel is impossible, because it means that you just have to completely suppress your needs and wants.
Yeah. And who you are, you know, constantly almost kind of looking around you to think, who does this person need me to be? How does this person need me to be? And always just constantly trying to change yourself to fit what you think that is. And the thing is, the people that love you, they want you and all that looks like, you know, the wholeness of who we are, the idiosyncrasies and the quirks and the, you know, the toxic bits, you know, we're all of those things. And we can, you know, I think I just wanted everyone to have half of me that felt the acceptable bits. But then that's not all of you. And people start wisening to that.
They do. And interestingly, when I asked you what your recurring excuses that you've made for yourself, it's this idea that if you share how you feel or express a need, you'll burden them. And that learning to be vulnerable is one of the things you've had to do in order to not let that excuse hamper your experience of life and people.
I think that's the bravest thing. I think often we see vulnerability as a weakness, but honestly, I think it saves lives. And I think I used to be someone that very much had this external, and my therapist used to say this to me. She used to say, Anna, you tell me everything that is challenging and then you tell me how you're sorting it out. She was like, there's no room for me to say anything. Why am I even here? You know, and I think I just had this shield that said, I've got this, don't worry about me, I'm fine, I'm gonna, you know, I'm sorting it out. If there's anything going on, it's fine, I've got this. And actually, you know, life became a lot less exhausting, a lot messier, when I said, actually, I don't have this always. And that's not failure or lack of strength, that's just fundamental humanness. We can't have our own backs all the time. It's just not sustainable. It's a survival mechanism, really. And it shuts people out and it shuts a big part of yourself off, and we deserve more.
I think when I read your answer, I thought I completely understand that. But then I think I can speak for listeners, and I can definitely speak from some of my own experience, where being vulnerable and asking for help, you don't always get the help that you want or that you need. And I think that can be really challenging. And it's difficult to say that out loud, because obviously people that I care about listen to this podcast. But I think for a while, when I was really struggling, I would say, I'm really struggling, I need some help. And yet sometimes I was expecting too much, or I was expecting people to deliver something that they simply didn't have the emotional toolkit to help me with, and that made me feel even more abandoned.
And I think, you know, that can be really painful. There can be a grief sometimes attached to that, when you start realizing that certain relationships, perhaps they're not able to meet that cry for help or that request for support. Sometimes we don't even know what that actually looks like. If they say, tell me how I can help you, and we don't know what that is. And then I think there's this whole sometimes leaning towards this desire to point out the good stuff. And I remember at a really challenging time in my life, when I was going through kind of postnatal depression, I reached out to a friend and she said, but Anna, look at what you've got. you know, look at what you've got. Just be grateful. People would kill to be in this situation. And I thought, yeah, and I am. But I'm also suffocating within it in a way. And I think we can be both. We can be both of those things. But for many people, it is that coping mechanism. And I think we lent on it so heavily in the pandemic, is that someone else is worse off. You know, kind of almost use that as leverage to make yourself feel better. And I think we can, gratitude is an amazing tool. Like, oh my goodness, I use it all the time. It brings balance to the challenging emotions. However, I think what we sometimes do is use that gratitude to invalidate. And I think often that's what we come up against when we take that step of vulnerability, is that kind of leaning towards the gratitude that actually you already have.
Mm.
You just need someone to sit with you in the messy stuff too.
Mm. Is there a way to be efficient at being vulnerable? So is there a way to open up and finally say, I do need your help, or I do need your support, and get back what you actually require? Is that a skill, or is it just a opening up?
I think first of all, we really need to start acknowledging what we need to for ourselves. I think a lot of the invalidation emotionally that we receive comes from ourselves, like in both the way that I've just spoken about, but also, you know, we all have our coping mechanisms, don't we? Maybe numbing those emotions or finding ways just to kind of shove them aside or busy them out. So I think the first step is really starting to label them for yourself, and maybe just simply saying, you know, I feel really overwhelmed, and that's okay. Not, I feel really overwhelmed, but I should be grateful. But, you know, so many people would be grateful to be in this situation and kind of beating it over the backside with a gratitude stick. But just starting to just acknowledge it for yourself and think, well, what do I need? Because then I think when we can start to validate and recognize and label our own emotions, we need less of that externally. So do you know what I mean? Like, we don't, that if someone these days, if someone doesn't get where I'm coming from, or they're not able for whatever reason just to kind of sit with me in that feeling, I can do that and I can validate it. So their invalidation or their lack of responding in a way that I need isn't a statement anymore of how valid that is. So I think that's a great place to start. I think another thing to do is just test the waters. You know, think of someone in your life who has historically been kind and supportive, and then maybe just give a little something. So next time they say, how are you? You know, you might want to just give a little bit more than normal. You might say, oh, I'm okay, I'm just having a bit of a rough day today, and see what they say. You know, we can just kind of edge our way in and grow in confidence with certain people. Like, we don't have to rip the Band-Aid off straight away. It can be quite painful to do that if we don't have that kind of internal validation going on as well, because then it's even more painful when we might get or not get what we need.
It's interesting what you say about what their reaction is and whether they validate your feelings, because I think, I don't know whether it's a, I was about to say, I don't know whether it's something that women tend to do more, but I guess that's just from canvassing friends, and the majority of my friends tend to be women. But I would say that a lot of the time I'll have conversations with friends and I'll say things like, this has happened. Am I mad to think this is such and such? And it's like, you already know that you feel that way. You want me to give you permission, or you want me to say, it's okay that you're feeling like that.
Yeah.
I think we do that a lot with our emotions, especially the perhaps more heightened or extreme ones.
Yeah, I think we just want to feel, we want to feel like we're not going mad. You know, we want to feel like it's okay to be feeling this way. And a lot of the stuff I talk about on social media, I talk about the really taboo emotions of, especially in the, on the backdrop of motherhood, kind of anger and rage and resentment and boredom and, you know, all these feelings that so often they don't kind of match up with how we feel we should be feeling, perhaps as mothers or perhaps as women or perhaps as partners. And we have a really high bar sometimes for the emotions that we kind of feel are acceptable. And just because you're a partner, or just because you're a mom, or just because, I don't know, you still have the full spectrum of human emotion. I think we just really make strong, we just apply such strong meaning to them. Emotions are just fleeting. They're not necessarily statements about how much you care about someone or don't. It's just a human response to what's going on in front of you. I think we apply a lot of meaning to the feelings that we have sometimes, give them a lot of power. So we start questioning ourselves. Yeah.
Was that something when you first started talking, the way that you were on social media, was the sort of the, I'm maybe not enjoying this as much as I thought I would, or were there a lot of whispers around the feelings around motherhood? Because as much as there are wonderful things about it, there are obviously, it's the hardest job in the world, famously. And yet perhaps it's taken us quite a while to, I say us, I'm not a mum, but it's taken people quite a while to be okay with saying that, because God forbid you do express anything negative about having children.
Yeah, I know. And I think, again, we need to be able to validate those in ourselves, because we're not necessarily going to get that external validation when you speak some of these things out. And I think I have the absolute privilege as a therapist of speaking to so many people. And I know full well that the emotions and feelings I have are very common. So I can speak with a confidence, right? I don't have shame around rage in motherhood. I might have shame around some of the behavior that comes out of the back of that. But, you know, I know that the more that we kind of wrap these emotions up in kind of rules, the more suppressed they become, the more they spurt out. You know, I was thinking the other day with my husband, we've been married, oh my gosh, like 13 years or something now, because I got married so young. And I was thinking, we bore each other, we annoy each other, we, you know, sometimes want space from each other. And that's because we're humans in relationship. But yet when we have those feelings around our children, suddenly it's not okay. But yet we're still humans in relationship. And it's these kind of really conflicting rules that we've kind of built up. And yeah, it feels taboo to say some of these things out loud. But I think that's the important thing, to start kind of, I don't know, putting cracks through the shame. Because it's just, we all have those feelings.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No feeling should be associated with shame.
Yeah.
I asked you what one of your biggest obstacles is that you've had to overcome. And I think this is where we're going to get deep, because you said people pleasing, and that it impacted every decision you made and every word you spoke.
Yeah.
How did it show up for you?
In every single way. I mean, I gave myself away until there was regularly nothing left. Like, my diary would be full to the brim of helping, you know, things, doing things for other people, or just saying yes to everything. And, you know, I'd be overthinking everything that I'd said. Have I upset that person? Have I, you know, if a text message was sent to me with a slight, I don't know, essence of anything, I'd be in pieces, kind of overthinking. And then I needed more validation, or I was kind of just looking for a sign that they weren't cross with me. And it was everything. Like, I didn't really have any boundaries. I just let them get steamrolled, because I just wanted to make people happy. And I thought, well, that's not a bad thing, is it? And people do like you to the main when you're trying to please them and you're saying yes to everything. Like, it kind of works. So,
I mean, the only reason I have a pained expression on my face is because everything you've just said is what my life was for a really long time. And I think it's that thing, you're constantly worried that someone's going to not like you. So you go above and beyond. That was definitely my experience as a people pleaser, was I will always be available, because God forbid I'm not.
Yeah.
So there was obviously some rejection and abandonment issues there as well. But it would be going above and beyond, reading a text message. I'm not, that sounds a little bit fun. So I'll say something super nice in my next message when I reply, and I'll reply really quickly. And the whole time I was in those dynamics, I was just trying to keep some sort of level where I felt safe, I guess. And actually, one of the most freeing things is releasing your grip on those.
Yeah.
Because then you realize what they really are. And one of the hardest things is going into therapy and realizing that actually you can feel really abused by that person or those people, But after a certain point, you come to realize you were also getting something out of it too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And hearing people pleasing termed as people pleading. Oh, like that just shone a massive flashlight on the whole thing for me. And, you know, I would never like to think that I was manipulating people, but actually I was. I was desperate to manipulate the way that they saw me. And I would have never, like, to me, it felt like an altruistic way to live. Mm. When actually I was needing so much from everybody around me. And, well, yeah, there was a manipulative element to that, out of desperation. And it's not because I was a bad person or because I was mean. It was because I was scared, really. And that's why I think with people pleasing, the biggest thing that we can do for ourselves is start to recognize our value without anyone else's pleased with us or not. Otherwise, we're just taken on this absolute roller coaster of, I'm a good person, I'm a terrible person, I'm a good person, I'm a terrible person, based on how someone worded a text message. And yeah.
It's so up and down, isn't it? It's this, your mood is entirely dependent on how someone else is treating you. And so, as you've just said, the work comes from building your own self-esteem. And I don't know about you, but I definitely got to a point where I realized I've never done that because I've always put someone else first. I thought I was worth so little that I thought my effort was best spent building up somebody who I already thought was amazing.
Yeah.
So it was, again, selfish. It's like I put them on a pedestal and I was like, I'm going to raise you up even further. And I didn't think I was, I don't know if you had this experience, I didn't think I was doing it selfishly. I didn't think there was anything bad in what I was doing. But at some point you do realize I'm not getting anything back.
You're getting nothing back. And it just breeds resentment in the end, because, you know, you might do something for someone, maybe they didn't even ask for you to do it, or they didn't want you to put quite that much time and energy in. So they're not going to shower you in all of the thanks that you feel you deserve for the cost that had to you. And often there was huge hidden costs. I might turn up to a party not wanting to be there, and then they don't even speak to me because they're speaking to their other friends. And I'm thinking, I'm absolutely exhausted. I didn't even want to come here. And now you're not even talking to me. You have no idea how tired I am because I've been out doing things every other night. And it's that, yeah, it's a lot of weight for other people to carry. And they're not even realizing the meaning of that to you. So you get let down quite a lot.
Mm.
It's a big ask on people. And it's a lot for you.
If someone's listening to this and they're suddenly realizing that they are caught in a real people-pleasing dynamic, what's the first way out? Like, what's the first step you need to take?
I think it's starting to recognize, you know, do you believe that everyone has equal value as a human? You know, I think of my kids and I think of the people that I love in my life, and I think of, you know, even the people that I was sat on the train with, that I know that if I really got talking to them and really, I'd love to know their stories. And I, you know, you'd think you'd find empathy and compassion for people that you don't even know yet. And I think, if we got equal value as humans, and if that is true, then where have you, why are you, what, you know, where are you in that? And why are you the exception to the rule? And you know, I speak to so many people who just really struggle with some of the kind of basic fundamental self-care aspects of, like, hydrating themselves, drinking enough water, you know, just resting, sitting down without feeling guilty that they're not doing stuff. And you think, what are those things saying of your worth? You know, what we show ourselves, what we think of ourselves and how we speak to ourselves and treat ourselves, just like with other people in our lives. And you know, some of us are consistently bullying ourselves. So no wonder we're going out into the world and feeling like we're not deserving of help and love and support and fun and rest and equal treatment. You know, I never used to take the last biscuit on the plate at work. Never, no matter how hungry I was, I would never take it. And now I think I'd probably be like, does anyone want this biscuit? I'm a bit hungry. You know, it's like I have equal right to space on the tube. I have equal right to a biscuit, you know, and I think Yeah. So it's starting to think, where have you been placing yourself and what have you been saying to yourself and how you treat and speak to yourself?
I love the biscuit thing, because it's almost like if you take the last biscuit, then people will notice. If there are 10 biscuits and you take the fifth biscuit or the sixth biscuit, you could get away with being somewhat invisible. And I think when I think about 10, 15 years ago, when I was definitely in dynamics that were people pleasing and perhaps weren't very healthy, I would almost try to leave them as though I was never there. But also, you know, if I sat on the sofa, I would get up and fluff the cushion as if I hadn't sat there, because I didn't want to hurt the sofa. I didn't want to do it.
Didn't want to give anyone the job of like flapping the cushion because you'd been there. Or yeah, I'd go to someone's house and they might forget to offer me a drink and I'd just be really thirsty. And I wouldn't say, do you mind if I can just grab a glass of water? You know, and I would now. And it's, you know, where's your voice? Are you valuing your voice? Are you valuing your literal space in this world as equal to that of those around you? And it's really hard to do that when our internal dialogue and those little kind of behaviors, those little choices that we're making are saying quite the opposite. You know, so it's an uphill struggle. So we need to start there, really.
I don't think one realizes necessarily either that you're in a dynamic like that. You just think, oh, I'm just being a really nice person. And then maybe every now and again, you feel racked with resentment. You're like, oh, why do I feel really angry at people? But you kind of can get over it. But I think it's taking that pause, isn't it, and saying, actually, where am I fitting in? Where am I putting myself on a list of priorities? And that's the really confronting job that sometimes someone needs.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
The help of a therapist to be able to actually do.
Yeah, absolutely. And thinking, would you speak to someone you care about in the way that you speak to yourself? And often the answer is, wow, absolutely not. So if it's not good enough for them, it's not good enough for you. It's not good enough for you either.
Would you say that you're a recovered people pleaser?
It's constantly something I think I'll be working on. However, it's so much easier now. Like, I used to have to really try and fight with myself, sometimes literally almost sit on my hands to stop me from raising it and be like, I'll do it. You know, going through my mind thinking, do I have capacity? Can I give a real authentic yes to this and do it out of a place of willingness and, you know, happily given sacrifice rather than burnout, resentment, and I'm going to need something from them that they're probably not going to be able to give me in return. It actually enables you to make more authentic decisions and to be more wholehearted in what you're giving people, which is, you know, it's good for relationship.
Can you spot, I can spot the person that I could get into a really unhealthy dynamic with a mile off now. And so I can make my escape route accordingly. But in the past, I would actually be drawn to those personalities, like a moth to a flame. I've said many times before on this podcast, I am like a heat-seeking emotional missile for the narcissist in the room.
Yeah, because it's a perfect pairing. You know, and they also keep you on your toes. So you might make them happy. You have to give a lot to make them happy. And then you could get it wrong. And then you have to please them all over again and try and earn it back. So it's kind of, it's a bit of a perfect, terrible pairing, really.
Can you spot people? Yes. Are you able to just now read a room in a way that you simply couldn't before, having figured out?
Yeah, historically, I can look over my life and be like, that's that dynamic, that's that dynamic, that's that dynamic. And it just had, I got to a point and it just had to stop, because I started seeing the pattern.
Mm.
And yeah, I'm grateful for that.
Have you been able to maintain any of those relationships, or in a way that's boundaried, or unfortunately when you recover from people pleasing, yeah, is one of the effects, casualties of,
yeah, there have been friendships that I've just had to separate myself off from, because that dynamic has been what has allowed them to survive.
Mm.
So when you step out of that dynamic, it's very hard for that relationship to exist. And I work a lot with people who have those dynamics in families, and that's really, really hard, because there's a whole grief journey attached to that. When you start realizing that in order to stop the dynamic, you might have to step away. And that is, you know,
mm-hmm,
that's hard.
That is tough.
Because you can really start implementing boundaries, but you can only implement boundaries from your side. You can't control whether that other person respects or accepts them.
It's like that saying, isn't it? If you love someone, set them free. And if they're meant to be, they'll come back to you. But that's really hard when it's like,
yeah,
your close friends and your family, because there can be that fear attached to putting that distance between you, because you're like, what if they don't make the next move?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, human relationship. It's complicated. It can be so complicated.
So complicated. Well, that's why we need to talk about it, I think, because I definitely for a long time lived in my own head and thought, I'm just a really garbage human. And these relationships are always so difficult and people treat me this way because I'm not worth very much. And actually, it isn't as simple as that. There might be elements of truth to it, but it isn't as simple as that. And I think unpicking it and realizing you speak to anybody, everybody's fallen out with somebody, everybody's got a tough dynamic with someone, or everybody struggles with boundaries in some form of relationship. And I think talking about these things and being really open about it,
yeah,
can make people feel far less alone, as if they're the problem.
Mm.
Because you're always going to be the common denominator in your own life.
Of course.
But that doesn't always mean that you're the problem,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, sometimes it can just be that we're kind of attracted to certain people,
mm,
that feed a dynamic that feels very familiar to us, even if it's not good.
Mm.
Because that other person gets something out of it and you get something out of it. And at the end of the day, sometimes you realize that you're just kind of perpetuating each other's, like, yeah, pain in a way.
Break the cycle.
Yeah, but it can come with a cost, and this is what happens when we can address people pleasing. Sometimes we start learning that there are certain people who really benefited from us not having boundaries, mm, and don't like the fact that we put them up. And then we can start questioning, is it wrong then that I'm putting this boundary here? And yeah.
It's work. Well, that's an, yeah, obstacle. Clearly, we could do another 2 hours on that, and it would probably descend into tears and just like,
yeah,
being in a ball on the floor. So let's talk about your biggest challenge today. And you actually said that there are several that I could choose from.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So parenthood is a challenge every single day.
Yeah, I've learned stuff about myself that I don't like and stuff that I'm incredibly proud of. I have learned how much energy we need as humans to be patient, but that we can if we fuel ourselves. I think I used to find rest very difficult.
Mm.
Like I'd kind of collapse into it rather than see it as something productive. And it's kind of looking after myself, doing nice things for myself. There would just be so much guilt around those things. And I have really, like, my whole opinion on that has been totally transformed, because I know that the relationships in my life, the only way they're going to be healthy is if I look after myself. It takes energy to be patient, to rationalize anxious thoughts. It takes energy to laugh.
Mm.
You feel so tired sometimes that you've got no sense of humor.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, exactly. You know, we have to resource ourselves so that we can enjoy life. And I think the very thing that I used to feel so much guilt around, I've now started realizing that engaging in those things is actually an act of love,
mm,
for the people around me. So I don't feel guilty anymore when I sit down or say I can't do that. Or, yeah, because I'm loving people around me,
mm,
by being kind to myself. And that's been such a turning point.
It's the favorite word of the day. It's a reframe, isn't it?
It's a reframe. Yeah. It really is. I need to do the things that I need to do so that I can give them what they need.
Mm.
And when we keep giving, this is how burnout happens, is that we kind of push through those, we push through the boundaries of our own kind of energies and limits and resources so many times over and over again. And then we just crash and we, you know, get sad and angry and resentful and exhausted and grumpy.
Yeah. And yet, I never rested when I was younger. I guess, as you said, you used to crash, you used to sleep a bit more. Nowadays, I would never think about a lie-in because I'm like, days to be had, life's for living. Whereas in my 20s, I think wouldn't think twice about having a lie. And I was wondering the other day about, is that why we feel tired as we get older? Because perhaps we do sleep less, but we also consciously spend less of our time in an inactive state, if you like, because we're like, got to get up, got to be moving, got to be doing. And we just simply weren't when we were younger.
And I think we just consume so much. We know kind of social media, we consume a lot on there and we're kind of always reading and researching and there's never a question that goes unanswered. Like someone only has to say, oh, one of my kids is like, when did this happen in the olden days? So we're whipping out our phones and there we go.
Why do we have eyelashes?
Why do we? Let me get Google out right now. I need to know. Is it to bat away the dust? We can find out anything in moments and our brains have to process all this stuff that we're putting in there. And we think, oh, I'm just scrolling. But our brains have to figure out what we need to know, what we don't need to know from all the stuff that's going past our eyes. And the other day, I've got this Garmin watch now. Oh my gosh, I love health data. It just gives me thrills. In an ideal world, I'd know that my body was exhausted, right? And I'd be so tuned in and, you know, but I've spent so many years overriding that and overriding all the little signals, you know, to slow down, you're doing too much, shouldn't keep working out like this, that I find it so interesting and helpful. Anyway, the other day I was on my sofa and I was scrolling Instagram. And I looked at my little watch data thingy and it showed stress. And then I thought, okay, I'm going to read my book. So I read a book for half an hour, rest, showed rest.
Which just it can show stress on your watch.
Yeah. But it just showed I was lying on my sofa, scrolling, and my body was experiencing that as mild stress. And then I read a book and a different part of our brain is used when we're kind of, it's more of a flow state. It's more kind of a different kind of wavelength. It's a lot more calming. Mm. And it showed, I was lying the same spot on the sofa, showed rest. So we're exhausted. And sometimes we don't even know why. But I think we're just consuming so much stuff. And our brain's like, what's useful? What do I need to know? Where do I need to put this? Oh, I've just read a terrible story. Oh, that person's got a really nice house. Oh, you know, we're just going down these. Yeah, it's exhausting. And we don't realize it.
We're also in the culture. We're also in the era of when you can hate watch things.
Yes.
So when we were growing up, you just watched things that you like. You elected to be in your home in front of the television when it was on because scheduled programming was a thing.
Yeah.
Whereas now you can access anything, but also you can access the things that you hate that you sort of somehow can't look away from.
Yeah.
Can you tell that this is something that I do or maybe have a problem with?
Just a little bit of an insight there.
But I sometimes am like, but I'm so transfixed by this that I simply cannot look away, but yeah, I know it's not good for me. So we've also got that going on, haven't we, of like, you know, it's not great for you,
but it's probably affirming something. You're looking so often we look for proof of what we think is true about ourselves or what we think is true, even if it's not good. So if I'm feeling rubbish, I might, you know, subconsciously be looking for other people's beautiful photos of their really functional families and their, you know, calm personas. And I'm like, there's proof. See, right there. And it's just, we're just looking to scratch itches and to be, we like to think that what we think about ourselves is right. We don't like to think we're wrong. So we tend to look for proof.
Yeah.
Which is why if we're feeling vulnerable, a bit vulnerable to comparison, we're more likely to go to the place that's going to really harm that and push us deeper into it. It takes discipline not to. And when you're tired, it's harder.
Is that why I do it at 3 o'clock in the morning when
Quite
I wake
possibly.
Up?
Possibly. maybe stop doing that a little bit. It's discipline. It's hard.
It is hard. Let's talk about something much nicer, which is your greatest success, which is your master's in psychotherapy.
There were so many things I could choose for this. I mean, the master's, I think, was just just where all of my work that I do now kind of came from.
Mm.
And I think I remember getting that certificate through because it was quite a slog. You know, I had to really get back into that academic headspace.
Yeah.
Write loads of essays, get kind of the accreditation, which was a huge kind of application that we had to do, and had to do 450 hours of supervised therapy. And it's, yeah, so it was, it did feel like a massive thing. And I think it's hard sometimes to just dwell, like just to take a moment and think, I was amazing. I'm really proud of myself for that.
Mm.
So I don't think we do that very often. I'm often just like, right, next.
We can linger in the losses and not enjoy the wins, I think.
Very true.
Especially, how long was that master's? Did that take?
That was, so the master's part was 2 years, and then it was another couple of years to get kind of the accreditation.
I almost feel with things like that, when it's taken a long time, is that when it's done, you almost go, oh,
yeah.
Phew.
Yeah,
rather than
letting out breath, like, oh, I didn't realize I'd been holding it for that long.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was, yeah, I'm very proud of that. And I'm proud of, you know, writing books and stuff as well. Like, that's just blows my mind sometimes.
Well, three incredible books.
Yeah.
Did you know that that was going to be a part of the, when you got the master's, the greatest success, did you think, and now for my next trick?
I've got bits of books that I started writing when I was 12. On my laptop, I've got random bits of books that I started writing when I was 19.
Wow.
And I've always just, I've just loved words and writing. And I remember Instagram's amazing because I think I would just write so much. I'd write these ridiculously long posts that would just, you know, get to the very end of the Instagram word limit. And I have to go and delete like spaces and
2,200 characters.
There we go. I'd be hyphenating everything and removing all the...
No paragraphs, no full stops.
No full stops. They can go. And I remember a literary agent sliding into my DMs and saying, have you ever thought about writing a book? And I'm like, yes, many times. And I was so excited. So excited. And it took, I think, 2 years between that point and the first one coming out, because another motherhood book was a bit of a risk, I think, for publishers to take.
Mm.
And I just wanted someone to take a little risk
on you.
And they did. So that's great.
So the books have been an incredible part of the journey. But one of your regrets actually is really tied into this, because you say it's the fact that you didn't do it earlier.
Yeah. I mean...
Not just the books, but the masters, everything
in
general.
Yeah, I mean... It's one of those things, isn't it, that I probably couldn't have. I think an even bigger regret than that is all the stuff. I think it's that I learned so much over the last number of years through training as a therapist, through having kids. I've learned so much. I wish I could go back and take that knowledge with me and do it again. Like, it'd be very interesting. How would it be different if I'd gone back with that knowledge, and mostly with that compassion for myself, to be honest, and patience for myself, because there wasn't any of that going on.
Were you not very compassionate to your younger self?
Oh, absolutely hated myself. Yeah, absolutely hated myself. Just, I think when every bit of my value and worth came from what I did for other people, you know, that there's nothing... You're never going to please everyone. And I think that was just excruciating for me, knowing that there were going to be some people I couldn't please and some people that wouldn't like me. And so I thought, actually, underneath it all, I'm not likable. I have to make people like me.
Hmm.
And yeah, there wasn't any self-compassion at all in the way that I was treating myself and the way that I was talking to myself. And I think that's been one of the biggest things that's changed. And I think that's why I'm so passionate about kind of inciting that in other people. Because from that, so much can change. You start treating yourself differently. You start putting your boundaries in different places, making different decisions. You start thinking, well, actually, I'm not an imposter if I go for that or if this is happening to me. And it just reshapes, and it reshapes everything.
Mm.
So I'd love to go back and give myself a dollop of that and see what happens.
Did you feel disconnected from who you were?
Yeah, because I literally felt like an imposter in my own life. You know, I was presenting this certain kind of person that I felt underneath it all, if they really knew what I was actually like, then they wouldn't like me. So yeah, I felt like a fraud.
Did you, I'm thinking about something I thought about earlier, and I'm just thinking about my old version of myself, who I would also like to go back give this insight to, is I never used to ask people to come over to where I lived, and if that was true for you. And I remember also sitting in a therapy session, and I was talking about the fact that I'd been cleaning my friend's house because they liked it a certain way. And my therapist saying, Do you clean your house in the same way? And long pause. And I was like, well, I'm not dirty, but I would say it's kind of disorganized. And she was like, okay. So you put more effort into what your friend's house looks like than what your home looks like, or how you live. Is that what you're telling me? And it's things like that that you're like, oh my gosh.
So someone just got a light and switched it on.
Yeah.
And you can't unsee that. And this is the amazing thing with these light bulb moments and these realizations. And we think, oh yeah, I'm not very nice to myself. But once you start realizing, you can't unknow that.
Mm.
And I mean, I remember I did some training when I was training, I learned how to do nails, gel nails, right? So I used to earn a bit of money to help pay for kind of living costs and stuff. So if a friend ever came over to my house, I'd want to do their nails almost as a payment for them coming to see me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd give them shoulder massages, and I just want to lavish people with a gratitude, because I didn't want them to regret coming. Or and it's like, wow, you know, now I can have someone over and it's enough to make them a cup of tea. You know, like, you're in my house, we're having a chat. Like, here's a cup of tea. Let's have a cup of tea together. I don't need to kind of, you know, give you beauty treatments as a thank you. And I remember this real pertinent moment after I'd had my third, and a friend wanted to come over and meet the baby. And I just said, you know, I started typing out, don't come over, I'm a mess. I just felt I was just a hormonal, just, I was so grumpy and tired. And then I thought, wait a minute, this isn't where I'm at anymore. So I just said, come over, I'm a mess. And she came over and gave me a hug, and it was amazing. And it's just such a shift. Like, you know, I think when we get to that place where we're saying, you know, I'm a mess, stay away. And then we get to that place where we're saying, you know, I'm a bit of a mess, come over.
Mm.
Like, that's when you think, these little things are working.
That's the vulnerability, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think sometimes people can think they're being strong by saying, stay away. I'm not in the right state at the moment. But actually the strength is saying, please come, because I'm not in the right state at the moment.
Yeah, and that's where the relationship's built as well. And that's where, you know, people really do feel more able to ask you in those moments. And it feels, it's a real privilege to see people when they're feeling vulnerable, and to know that they've let you into that moment, and to just sit with them, even if you can't really help them. And that's not nothing. That's, you know, that's really intimate. And that's how relationships built.
Yeah. It's interesting. I'm thinking, and just be very open, as I always am on this podcast, but I hate my birthday. Hate it. So my last birthday, I didn't want to speak to anybody. I just hid, basically. And then a few weeks later, a friend came over and said, look, I know you really struggle on your birthday. I was going to come over, but I just got the sense that you would tell me to naff off. And actually what happened was I had a cry and said, I don't know why, it's completely irrational. I really, really dislike my birthday, but it means the world to know that you even thought to come over, because you know that. And I mean, I didn't say I'm a mess, come over. I still hid.
Yeah.
But I would never have admitted that before. And I think going back to what we were talking about right at the top about being vulnerable, so important.
Sometimes there's another layer, isn't there? Even if you've had some therapy and even if you've been working on it. I remember in lockdown, I think it was my first book was out, and I came downstairs and my husband and the kids had like laid the table and done cake and were all dressed up. And I honestly, I wanted to walk out the door. It makes me want to cry because I just felt so uncomfortable. It was just that attention. It was on, you know, just in the way that you might have felt if your friend had come over and come with some flowers, that kind of, that in your face acknowledgement and pride and gratitude of who you are to them. And I think it really upset me because I was like, oh my gosh, I've worked so hard on this. Why is this uncomfortable? And it's just another layer every now and again. And it doesn't mean that we haven't, that what we've been doing and what we've been trying to work on hasn't worked. It just means that every now and again, there's just another layer that gets peeled away. And you're like, oh, this is a deeper layer of discomfort. Mm-hmm. And actually the next book that was out, I let it happen and I let them celebrate me, and it was uncomfortable, but I let it, you know, I didn't want to run out the door crying. And then the next one, I actually really welcomed that and celebrated it together. So sometimes there is just another layer that gets peeled away.
And I think sometimes we can think that because somebody's done the work, or they're like, oh, I was depressed, or I had a breakdown, but I'm not presenting in that way anymore, people can think, oh, fixed, all done. And actually, one of my favorite expressions, because I find it quite comforting, is recovery isn't linear.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can have come such a long way and then something will set you back massively. And you're like, okay, well, thank God I've got the coping mechanisms I've got from the work I've done to deal with that. But that really has thrown me and I wasn't expecting it.
Yeah, it's like growing pains, isn't it? Remember when your parents say growing pains? I remember, you know, my legs are aching. Growing pains.
I'm 5'4". I didn't have many growing pains.
I had a few growing pains. And it's sometimes we're just growing into a new space. And, you know, we haven't shrunk and taken a step back. We're just growing into a bigger experience of whatever that was to us. And it's still growth.
Yeah.
It
is still growth. You're absolutely right. I'm realizing that we're hurtling towards our time together because we've allowed ourselves to get very deep today. I want to ask you about your weakness, because you said that it was perfectionism and a dodgy attitude to the rest that means that you regularly find yourself burnt out. And I would imagine that a lot of people listening to this podcast can absolutely relate to this idea that you've got to be perfect. And I don't think we expect that of any group of people more than mothers.
Yeah.
I think the idea that you've got to be absolutely perfect, can't put a foot wrong, and your child also has to behave completely perfectly and have all the right things, that is such a huge pressure. So how have you been able to, release yourself from a perfectionist mindset?
Yeah, constantly having to do so, to be honest. Do you know what I think? Recognizing that the world is incredibly imperfect, and if I'm trying to replicate some kind of perfection, then I'm not actually preparing my children very well to navigate the world. Supporting them through disappointment and the repair that comes when I've shouted or I've parented in a way that I'm not proud of, and I can find ways to explain to them that sometimes we're just tired and grumpy and, you know, we don't say nice things and I'm really sorry and I love you. And I think that's been really helpful, and not beating myself up when it goes awry, and choosing not to kind of let that guilt turn into shame. Because I think sometimes we go from I've done a bad thing that wasn't ideal to I am a bad person, I don't deserve my kids, or I don't deserve the love that comes from them. And then we can find ourselves kind of defending ourselves against love and connection. And so when I feel guilty now, I just think, well, there's a prompt to have me look at what went on and what might I do? What do I need? Do I actually just need to go for a walk or rant to a friend? And focusing on the repair more than trying to be right all the time, because that's just not realistic or sustainable, and will find us in burnout and being cross with ourselves. And my kids don't need that either.
Do you now, can you now spot burnout before it happens?
I'm not very good at that, to be honest. My therapist often says, you know, it's funny, Anna, because suddenly you're here again. And I just, you know what? I love my job. I love it. I love, you know, I've got a really full and fast life, and it's fun. It's hard. And I think I have to really make space for rest. I went through a burnout a couple of years ago that I've never experienced anything like. It was really visceral. It was like a full nervous system burnout after the pandemic. And it really scared me because it made me realize how, you know, we're not just ahead doing all the things, dragging our body along. You know, we are a full body in person, and we need to be respecting, you know, all the different facets of ourselves. And we need to rest. It's a human requirement. It's not an indulgence. It's, yeah, if we want to do good things, we need to rest as well. We need to put in what we're putting out. And that was, yeah, it was very humbling. That experience really made me start respecting my body and my nervous system and what I'm asking of it and what I'm giving it in return.
It's that thing, isn't it, of you can go through a burnout or anything a few times, and then there'll be a time where you think, oh no, next time I even smell that, yes, in the distance or see the shape of it coming, I will know that that means an emergency stop. It's not just about, oh, I will make time when. It's no, we're stopping now.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't want to get to that place again. So I think for me, it's my mom or a friend texts me and I feel like that's an inconvenience. I'm like, oh, it's just another thing to do. You know, when maintaining relationships that are really important to me, in a few text messages, or, you know, when that feels too much, that's a real flag. Yeah.
You're just making me chuckle, because at the end of last year, I was just, every time my email went or anything, I'd just be like,
yeah,
at my computer, just telling it to F off or just swearing at inanimate objects, because I had allowed myself to get too far down that road. It was making me chuckle. Right. Let's talk about, because this really feeds into it, actually. I asked you about a time when you were wrong and you said when you thought you could do it all over and over and over again, inevitably that would lead to burnout. So how did you realize you couldn't do it all? How did you make peace with that?
Yeah.
And what strategies have you put in place so that your cup is full but doesn't runneth over?
Yeah. So it was actually that burnout, and we were meant to go away for our first break after the pandemic when you could, and we were going to my husband's kind of family home in Wales. And I was in such a way that even thinking of packing would send me into a state of panic and tears. And my husband couldn't even broach what time shall we leave, because I would start crying. So on the day it came to pack, he took the kids out. And I remember sitting on the floor in the kitchen with a water bottle in a jute bag, crying, because I could not even face, I couldn't do it. I literally couldn't do it. I couldn't even face the thought of being in a car with five of us and the kids. And, you know, it was, I didn't have it in the tank, and I felt so painfully guilty. And I called my mum crying, and she said, Anna, what if you just don't go? And suddenly I felt this massive just release and relief and guilt of I can't. And that means no one can, really. That means it's not happening. And that's really sad. And I felt this massive guilt, and I suddenly thought, wait a minute, this has come because I have been the cost in this pandemic. You know, my resources have been great, just trying to keep everything going and everyone together. So, you know, if I put a holiday on a credit card as a family credit card, that would be our debt to pay. You know, that would be, if we were to go away and enjoy that holiday, we would then have to repay that debt. We benefited from that debt. We need to repay it. And I thought, my burnout is basically the debt. So therefore, and I have spent myself on the collective. I've had to. And therefore, we need to repay that debt as a family. The cost is the family cost. And it really helped me, I think, recognize that my burnout is not just my burnout, it's everyone's. Like, it affects everyone. So therefore, I need to recruit my family so that I can get the things that I need, so that I can give them what they need. So the kids will see me working out. The kids will have me saying, wait a minute, no, I'm just resting on the sofa 5 minutes. I'll do that in 5 minutes. Or my husband, you know, can you take over because I just need a breather? You know, so I ask for help now, because I know that they need me to ask for help. And I don't feel like I'm burdening people, because I know what the real cost in the end of not doing that is that I can't help anyone. And then things really do fall apart a bit.
It's such an incredible journey, because even at the beginning of this podcast, we talked about how the fear of saying what you need, or actually not even having the skills to know how to articulate what you need because it was something that you hadn't done before, coming all the way to the end of this conversation, you not only know how to express yourself, but you know when is appropriate, and you also know the impact it has on the people around you.
Yeah.
It sounds as though, it feels as though it's been a real gift, not just for you, but for your life and your family too.
Yeah, I think so. I think these things often can be the messiest bits.
So let's end with what makes you hopeful. And you said, which I love, because we've gone from perfectionism to this, my increased acceptance of life's and my messiness. Mm. So you don't fight against it anymore. You're far more likely to go with the flow and have patience and grace for yourself.
Yeah. And it's wonderful. You know, I'm really annoying. I literally lock myself out the house so many times. It's like a joke. I drop things. I break things. I forget things. I turn, you know, rock up to my kids' school on Where We Like Day and they're in their uniform. I think I just used to be so cross with myself all the time. And now I just like lovingly eye roll at myself and think, oh, here we go again. And I just think that shift is huge, because we all have these little things about us, and you know, some things maybe we can change, and maybe sometimes it's just best to accept that, you know, I do stuff like that, and that's just part of who I am.
Yeah.
So yeah. And then the other stuff, you know, the emotional messy stuff, letting people in when it's happening rather than when it's all kind of tied up neatly with a bow at the end, and I can talk about it in retrospect. And
yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, don't worry, there's nothing you need to do.
Yeah, it's all good.
All sorted, yeah. But just so you know.
Yeah, this happened, but I'm fine now.
Yeah, move those barriers a little bit. It's been so lovely to chat to you. And actually, I think you mentioned a couple of times about light bulb moments, and I think what you do with your podcast, because it's 10 minutes and then 20 minutes, is, and you'll know this from having been in the therapy room, and you take these conversations out of the therapy room, sometimes you can hear the same saying, or you can say the same thing out loud a dozen times, but there's this one time when it can just be a few words, a sentence, a phrase, whatever it might be, that suddenly hits you in a way that it didn't hit you before. And once you hear it in that way, you can't unhear it. Yeah. And it forever changes you. And I think that's what you do really skillfully with the podcast, and that you sort of fashion them into these light bulb moments. And so if you are listening to this and you are feeling that any of what we've talked about resonates, you are probably likely going to listen to your podcast and hear something that will make that change, be the change that you needed to hear.
Thank you. That's what I hope. And they're all just light bulb moments I've had. I just throwing them out there, hoping to switch on some more.
I love it. Just light bulbs everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining. It's been a pleasure to chat.
Oh, thank you for having me. I've loved it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, then make sure you're subscribed so you never miss a show. And why not tell a friend about the podcast? If you want to watch what happens behind the scenes, then head over to my Instagram, where I'm at Emma Guns. And if you want to get in touch with me and share any risks, obstacles, challenges, or curveballs that you've faced and overcome, then tell me on thebeautypodcast@gmail.com. And it may feature in one of the midweek shows. Thank you so much for tuning in. I will see you on the next one.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.